Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, December 29th, 2005. I'm Chris Andre. The state of Oregon has vastly underestimated the number of people who need and qualify for social services. Jose Padilla's attorneys want the Supreme Court to define the limits of Bush's executive power after the case shifted direction again this week. And a Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up at an Israeli military checkpoint in the West Bank today. Portland area weather, showers decreasing, rain this afternoon and tonight, highs 45 to 50. Tonight rain increasing locally, heavy temperatures in the low to mid 40s, windy on the coast, gusts up to 65.
Oregon Social Services face a huge cut because of fiscal mismanagement in the Department of Human Services. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside has the story.
Oregon's biggest state agency, the Department of Human Services, has $172 million less than it says it needs. Officials say Tuesday that cutting the budget could force reductions in health care and other services to the poor. The budget hole is larger than the legislature's emergency board can cover. The board, which gives money to agencies when the legislature is not in session, has about $29 million available, and some legislators suggested a special session may be necessary to ensure the agency remains able to provide crucial services. The DHS director says he failed to correctly forecast the increase in demand for health care through the Oregon Health Plan, especially among programs that provide services to the elderly, blind, disabled, and low-income adults and children. The budget the legislature passed in August was based on caseload data that was more than 5 months old. For KBOO News, I'm Sheila Whiteside.
An opinion issued by Oregon's Attorney General Hardy Myers will help the state define its new utility tax law. The opinion gives Oregon regulators broad leeway in how to carry out the new law, which will link income taxes paid by utilities to the rates they charge their customers. Myers' opinion came in response to a request by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. The PUC asked for help in interpreting key provisions of the new law. The legislation requires that there be rate adjustments that reflect both income taxes paid by utilities and the amounts collected from customers to cover those expenses. Enron for years paid little or no federal or Oregon income taxes, even though its subsidiary, Portland General Electric, collected about $90 million from ratepayers for tax expenses.
Oregon State University Extension Service is plowing more money for education into a long-neglected field, small farms. OSU is hiring five extension agents who will specialize in advising and teaching operations of small farms and ranches better ways to grow crops, raise livestock, and market them. Agriculture leaders say keeping small farms profitable will reduce pressure to subdivide or otherwise develop the land. Throughout its history, OSU Extension Service has emphasized research and education for operators of larger farms who wholesale most of their output to food processors, grocery chains, and other big volume buyers. The university has been criticized for responding inadequately to increasing consumer interest in organic fruits, vegetables, and other food. Before the improving Oregon economy allowed the 2005 legislature to increase extension service funding, Gary Stevenson was the only small farm specialist, and most of his knowledge is in livestock rather than crops.
C-Tran is turning to the sun to help bus drivers spot waiting passengers at night, according to the Oregonian. 90 solar-powered poles called I-stops are being installed along C-Tran's busiest routes. The poles, which have the bus stop signs mounted on them, feature a flashing beacon that tells the driver a passenger is waiting. 40 of the stops include a streetlight for waiting passenger safety. Missed passengers are among the leading customer complaints among the nation's bus systems. The Federal Transit Administration provided $50,000 through a transit enhancement grant to pay for the project. Although riders said they thought the lighted poles were a good idea, many still expressed a desire to have the transit system's reduced hours restored.
From 1998 to early 2001, federal investigators seemed powerless to stop the fires that were set using gasoline-filled 5-gallon plastic buckets. The fires were followed with calling cards from the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. Investigators were tight-lipped about what they found, but apparently had little to work with. But the wire handles and metal remains of the white plastic buckets and a few intact buckets filled with gasoline that failed to ignite. In 2002, investigators got a break when one of the people involved in firebombing a logging company and a gravel pit in 2001 told his girlfriend, and she told her father, a state fire marshal. Three people were convicted, and alleged leader Michael Trey Errol Scarpetti is being held in Victoria, British Columbia on a shoplifting charge, fighting extradition. 3 years later, six people in Oregon, Arizona, Virginia, and New York were arrested on charges from six fires and a toppled electric transmission tower in Oregon and Washington. One of them, Stanislaus Meyerhoff, has agreed to testify for the prosecution. Although a spokesman for ELF had described the group as immune to infiltration, federal agents found an informant in late 2004 who showed them how one of the fires was set and wore a hidden microphone while talking to old pals about past exploits. When they were arrested earlier this month, the six had taken up new lives. Chelsea Gerlach, Country Girl, was a DJ in Portland, living with animal rights activist Darren Thurston. Meyerhoff, 28, who went to high school with Gerlach, was attending Piedmont Community College in Virginia. Kevin Tubbs was living in Springfield. Daniel McGowan was working for a women's advocacy law firm in Brooklyn, New York. William Rogers lived in the back of his Catalyst Info shop. He died in jail in Flagstaff, Arizona, the victim of an alleged suicide. The sixth activist, Sarah Kendall Harvey, was an administrative assistant and graduate student at Northern Arizona University and had applied to medical school. Activists are alerted that more arrests may be on the way.
Local activists are on edge over revelations that the federal government has engaged in illegal spying activities for the past several years. Local attorney Paul Loney spoke with KBOO's Spencer Raymond about the history of local activists under surveillance, as well as to give a few tips for those who worry about their own civil rights.
First, give us some background on surveillance of local activists. I mean, is there any history of that in Portland?
Well, yes. Back in the Vietnam War days, they monitored protests to see if people were planning to storm draft centers to try and destroy the draft records, recruiting centers. That's pretty clear in all the records that have been released in the time since then. And during the Bush protest days, and even when Clinton was here, people protesting, they would have people in the crowd dressed as activists monitoring things to see if the crowd would somehow do something they didn't like. You know, they had walkie-talkies sort of hidden in their backpacks, but it was pretty easy to pick out who the people that pretended they were activists that weren't. And even when people were protesting the Trojan shutdown because of the whole nuclear power issue, they were worried about activists somehow doing something with nuclear power, which is kind of laughable.
Now, what are some of the biggest violations of civil rights on that issue that you know of in Portland?
Well, of course, here, that Brandon Mayfield. That whole thing was such a fiasco, and poor Mr. Mayfield and what he went through in his family, where they just went in, you know, they go into his home and searched his home without telling him, and started monitoring his mail and his email, his computer records, and what his children were doing in school. That was pretty amazing.
Now, Paul, I mean, does it matter if someone is engaged in illegal activity, or, I mean, can any legal, political organization or speech trigger an investigation or a covert spying?
Well, what they're always worried about is that something that's legal becoming illegal, and then they're always paranoid about that. I mean, people have the right to protest. You have the right to redress your grievances, and so they're always trying to infiltrate these protests and to either spin it the way they want to or sort of nip it in the bud by telling people to do something illegal so they can stop it and arrest the leaders right away before it gets out of hand, in their words.
Now, what should people do if they worry that they could be caught up in a situation like this?
Well, if someone they don't know or only know slightly starts to suggest something illegal, I would state very loudly that I never participate in illegal activities. That way, if there's any tape recorders, hidden wires picking up, that you're on the record as soon as this person brought it up saying, I don't participate in illegal activities and I don't support them. Just so you're on record, if they're taping it, that you said that.
That was Portland attorney Paul Loney, interviewed by Spencer Raymond of KBOO.
Ted Kulongoski's first chief of staff, Peter Bragdon, says he agreed only to a temporary gig and left after 18 months on the job. Bragdon's replacement, fiscal wizard Teresa McHugh, says she was brought in to help rescue a nearly busted state budget, did that, and moved on. Now Kulongoski is on his third chief in as many years. The staff attrition rate highlights what has become a hallmark of his administration, high turnover in key staff positions. Staff members past and present deny that the turnover signals problems inside Kulongoski's administration or conflicts between them and his management style. They, along with lobbyists, lawmakers, and other Salem insiders, say the governor has recruited a more politically savvy support team. This is seen as reflecting his decision to run for re-election and a desire to work more closely with the next legislature. Whether the changes spark a new direction for the Democratic governor remains to be seen. What is clear is that the staffing changes have given fuel to critics who say Kulongoski has failed to make traction on some of the state's most pressing issues because of a shifting, unfocused agenda. Kulongoski has overseen regular cabinet-level shakeups. Besides three staff chiefs, three people have served as communication director, as deputy press aides, and as legislative liaisons. He's had two chief legal counsels and two labor advisors. In all, more than a dozen of the governor's advisors have left or moved to other positions in his office. This according to the Oregonian.
Richard Causey, former top accountant with Enron, has pleaded guilty to securities fraud before a U.S. judge, according to the BBC. Causey was attending a court hearing ahead of the trial next month of Enron's top two executives. The ex-accountant said he would plead guilty in exchange for a possible 7-year jail sentence. As part of the plea bargain, it now looks likely that Causey will testify against his former bosses, Jeffrey Skilling and Tom Lehr. Richard Causey was due to go to trial on January 17th with Enron's former chairman, Ken Lay, and former president, Jeff Skilling. However, in light of this latest development, the trial has now been delayed until January 30th.
The Corporate Crime Reporter released a report yesterday in which it analyzes the new policy by the Department of Justice to offer major corporations, including Adelphia, KPMG, Merrill Lynch, MCI, and others, special deals that allow prosecutors to not criminally prosecute corporations accused of wrongdoing. For Free Speech Radio News from D.C., Anastasia Nezdiska has more on these non-prosecution agreements.
The report, called Crime Without Conviction, The Rise of Deferred and Non-Prosecution Agreements, details 34 special agreements that were established between corporations and the Department of Justice since June 2002, the last time when the company, Arthur Andersen, was actually convicted. The report finds that prosecutors have entered into twice as many non-prosecution and deferred prosecution agreements with major American corporations in the last 4 years than they have in previous 10 years. The author of the report, Russell Mockheiber, talks about one such agreement entered with KPMG Company.
In August of this year, KPMG, one of the Big Four accounting firms, admitted to criminally engaging in a fraud that generated at least $11 billion in phony tax losses, which cost the United States at least $2.5 billion in evaded taxes. Nonetheless, KPMG was granted a deferred prosecution agreement. At the press conference, which I attended at the Justice Department, announcing the deferred prosecution agreement, the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, said that KPMG, quote, has admitted to criminal wrongdoing in the largest ever tax shelter fraud. Yet there was no criminal conviction.
Under a deferred prosecution agreement, the prosecutor charges corporation with a crime, but agrees to drop the charge if the corporation fulfills its promises to the prosecutor, such as fines, cooperation, monitors, and indictment of particular executives. According to Mockheiber, these agreements set a trend for a dramatic shift in the prosecutorial practice in the U.S. when it comes to corporate crime.
10 years ago, it was save the individuals and plead the corporation. Now, the government has set up a system where it's save the corporation by sacrificing the individuals. So often what you see is the defense counsel cooperating with the prosecutor to save the corporation from a conviction, turning everything over about the executives and the executives being convicted.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
Lawyers for Jose Padilla, a U.S. citizen held as an enemy combatant for nearly 4 years, want the Supreme Court to resolve how much power a president has while the nation is at war. Lawyers Donna Newman and Andrew Patel told the High Court in papers filed this week that the justices must step in to preserve the vital checks and balances on the president. In another twist to the case, Solicitor General Paul Clement asked the Supreme Court yesterday to order Padilla's transfer from military to civilian custody immediately. In their filing, Newman and Patel cited the Bush administration's interpretation of the president's war powers to justify its decision to hold Padilla until recently without charges in a military brig in South Carolina. Padilla's lawyers also said Bush abused his war powers authority by approving warrantless surveillance of conversations between people in the United States and abroad who had suspected terrorist ties. Such developments underscore the need for this court to address the fundamental constitutional questions presented by the case. Padilla's appeal concerns not only broad questions of presidential power, but also seeks to resolve whether Padilla should remain in military or civilian custody.
The National Security Agency's internet site has been replacing files on visitors' computers that can track their web surfing activity despite strict federal rules banning most of them. These files, known as cookies, disappeared after a privacy activist complained and agency officials acknowledged yesterday they had made a mistake. Nonetheless, the issue raises questions about privacy at a spy agency already on the defensive, amid reports of a secretive eavesdropping program in the United States. Cookies are widely used at commercial websites and can make internet browsing more convenient by letting sites remember user preferences. But privacy advocates complain that cookies can also track web surfing even if no personal information is actually collected. A senior official must sign off on any issue on any such use, and an agency that uses them must disclose and detail their use in its privacy policy. The Bush administration has come under fire recently over reports it authorized NSA to secretly spy on email and phone calls without court orders.
The three military service chiefs have been dropped in the Bush administration's doomsday line of Pentagon succession. The three were pushed beneath three civilian undersecretaries in Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's inner circle. The doomsday line is the order of succession should top Pentagon officials meet with an unforeseen demise. A little-noticed holiday week executive order from President Bush moved the Pentagon's intelligence chief to the number three spot in the succession hierarchy behind Rumsfeld. The second spot would be the Deputy Secretary of Defense. The Army chief, which long held the number three spot, was dropped to sixth. The changes are the second in 6 months and mirror the administration's new emphasis on intelligence gathering versus combat in 21st century war fighting. Technically, the line of succession is assigned to specific positions rather than the current individuals holding those jobs. But in its current incarnation, the Doomsday Plan moves to near the top three undersecretaries who are Rumsfeld loyalists and who previously worked for Vice President Dick Cheney when he was Defense Secretary. The changes were recommended because the three undersecretaries have a broad knowledge and perspective of all overall Defense Department operations. The service leaders are more focused on training, equipping, and leading a particular military service.
The Army can account for $68 million in parts and tools shipped to contractors for repairs in 2004. Congressional auditors say this because it doesn't demand receipts. In earlier audits, the General Accounting Office found a similar lack of basic accounting oversight with Navy and Air Force parts and tool shipments. Each year, the Army ships thousands of items, ranging from small tools to turbine engines, to private contractors for repair, alterations, or modifications. Looking at data from two inventory control points, the GAO investigators said 15% or $68 million of the unclassified shipments they analyzed could not be confirmed as being received. The GAO said another 42% couldn't be reconciled with shipping records. Discrepancies also were found in records for 37% or about $8.1 million worth of shipments of classified parts and tools. The GAO said the head of the Army's Material Command should look at providing contractors advance notice of shipments, require quarterly status reports, and better document contractors' receipts of shipments. The Army had no immediate response Wednesday to the final report.
Sunni Arab and secular groups refused today to open discussions with the Shiite religious bloc leading Iraq's parliamentary elections. They are demanding a full review of the contested results. Their refusal could deepen the political turmoil following a UN observer's endorsement of Iraq's December 15th elections. The official said the results were credible and that the results should stand. Preliminary results from the vote have given the governing Shiite religious bloc, the United Iraqi Alliance, a big lead. But the UIA would still need to form a coalition with other groups. The UN endorsement came yesterday after opposition groups demanded international intervention and an independent review of more than 1,500 complaints about irregularities. There were no Sunni Arabs or secular Shiites at the meeting between Kurdish and Shiite leaders earlier this week. Preliminary results also indicated that Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Ahmad Shalabi, a convicted criminal, will not be re-elected to the new 275-member parliament. Shalabi instead will head up Iraq's oil ministry.
Peruvian national Wilder Gutierrez Rubio was part of a 200-man Peruvian contingent sent to Iraq in early October to provide security for Baghdad's Green Zone. Rubio died a few hours after arriving in Lima, Peru, earlier this month. Days before, he had been diagnosed with severe leukemia at Ibn Sina Hospital in Baghdad and immediately flown back to his home country. It's widely suspected in Peru that Gutierrez's leukemia was the result of exposure to high levels of uranium in Iraq. Gutierrez is one of more than 1,000 Latin Americans recruited by U.S. private security contractors to work as mercenaries, performing dangerous jobs in the countries under U.S. military occupation. Their deaths underscore the emergence of a cheap labor market for mercenaries that has thrived in recent months. Since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, about 20,000 mercenaries have been hired to work as private security contractors. This figure represents one mercenary for every 7 uniformed American soldiers in these regions. The U.S. government spent $30 billion on private security contractors in 2004. This is the largest expenditure in Iraq after oil and construction, according to the World Socialist website.
A Palestinian suicide bomber trying to enter Israel blew himself up today at a military checkpoint in the West Bank, set up to foil the attack. He killed an Israeli soldier and 2 other Palestinians. The army said it had set up the checkpoint shortly after receiving warnings that a suicide bomber was headed toward Israel. The bomber was traveling in a taxi that was stopped at the roadblock for a security check. After the vehicle was stopped, 3 occupants got out, including a man wearing a large overcoat. When soldiers ordered him to remove the coat, he detonated an explosives belt concealed beneath. The suicide bombing took place just south of the Palestinian town of Tulkarem, about 2 miles inside the West Bank. The army said the bomber, an accomplice, and a taxi driver were killed. 1 Israeli officer died and 3 were wounded, 1 seriously. Palestinian ambulances took away an unknown number of wounded Palestinians. The bombing came hours after Israeli warplanes and artillery pounded the northern Gaza Strip. The violence is just the beginning of an aggressive new Israeli campaign to stop Palestinian rocket fire.
Tense negotiations were underway last night to try to secure the release of a British human rights worker and her parents. The 3 were abducted in the Gaza Strip. The 25-year-old woman, identified as Kate Burton, was showing her parents around the town of Rafah near the Egyptian border when they were bundled into a car and driven off, this according to The Guardian. Foreigners have frequently been kidnapped in Gaza, but they have never been harmed or held for more than a couple of hours. A spokesman for a Palestinian human rights group, Al-Mizan, said Burton worked for them but was on leave at the time of the abduction. The abductions come at an edgy moment in the run-up to Palestinian elections on January 25th. There have been a series of armed incidents in the Gaza Strip and West Bank as members of the ruling Fatah movement insisted they be given an opportunity to take part in the ballot. Last week, Fatah split into two factions in a struggle for ascendancy between older members and young guard frustrated at marginalization. That split was overcome yesterday in a concerted effort to defeat Hamas in the elections. The Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas welcomed the reunification of the Fatah list. It will be led by Marwan Barghouti, who has been jailed by Israel.
A ceremony is due to take place in Banda Aceh shortly to mark the withdrawal of a final batch of Indonesian troops from Aceh province. The pullout is the last military step in a peaceful peace deal agreed with rebels from the Free Aceh movement, aimed at ending 26 years of bitter conflict. The rebels have already handed in their weapons and dissolved their armed wing in return for the cessation of violence. The province is being given more autonomy. The BBC's Jakarta correspondent says it was the tsunami a year ago which devastated large areas of Aceh province, which seems to have impelled both sides towards peace. More than 120 international aid organizations are now based in Aceh. Areas that were still no-go zones in the first few months after the tsunami are now opening up, and the underlying threat that foreigners might be asked to leave has receded. According to Agence France-Presse, hundreds of people have gathered in Banda Aceh to witness the ceremony marking the troop withdrawal. In total, 24,000 soldiers will have been pulled out of the province since the peace agreement was signed in Finland last August. Under the deal, the Indonesian government is committed to stationing no more than 14,700 soldiers and 9,100 police in Aceh, all of which are to be locals. Before the agreement was signed, Indonesia had more than 35,000 soldiers and 15,000 police in the province. The deadline for the decommissioning of rebel weapons and withdrawal of Indonesian forces was the end of the year. Former rebels have handed in more than 800 weapons to international monitors. This from the BBC.
Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian Prime Minister, in effect, let himself off one of the most serious criminal charges against him, according to documents lodged with a Milan court. In September, a court acquitted him of falsifying the accounts of his business to cover up an almost $10 million illegal donation to the party of the late Prime Minister Bettino Craxi. In a delayed ruling, the judges said Berlusconi and three former bosses of his Fininvest firm could not be convicted because what they had done was no longer a crime. This came following a law change after Berlusconi came to power in 2001.
A Greek lawyer said yesterday he had filed a criminal complaint against nine intelligence agents, including a Briton, for the alleged detention and torture of Pakistani immigrants in Greece after the July 7th London bombings. Frangiskos Ragousis filed a complaint this week against the Briton and eight Greek agents. If formal charges are filed, Ragousis says he will seek the Briton's extradition. 28 Pakistanis claim they were abducted from their homes in Greece and interrogated by Greeks and apparently native English speakers. An official inquiry has begun into the claims. This according to The Guardian.
In the Cable Morning News for Thursday, December 29th, 2005. Chris Andre, Kathleen Stevenson, and Brian Smith edited the news. Cable's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, and Cable's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and Brian Smith is on the board right now. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We welcome your participation in the AM Newsroom. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Reach us by email, www.kabu.org, or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Check out the new improved website at www.kabu.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to catch us at 5 p.m. for a full hour of solid news on the KABU Evening News. Portland area weather today, showers decreasing, rain this afternoon and tonight, highs 45 to 50. Tonight, rain increasing, locally heavy. temperatures in the low to mid 40s, windy on the coast, gusts up to 65 miles per hour. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 7:30, Joanne Bowman and Alan Graf host Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. It's Alan's last day, so call in and say goodbye. At 9, Jade Pikala hosts the Radio Zine. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, hear part 3 of Will Seaman's series on Israel-Palestine. His guest is Tanya Reinhardt, professor at Tel Aviv University and the University of Utrecht. She is the author of Israel-Palestine, How to End the 1948 War. And at 10:30, Damali Ayo guest hosts Art Focus. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Thank you very much for listening.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Thursday, December 29th, 2005. Friends of Trees is taking orders for neighborhood tree plantings in Southeast Portland every Saturday through March 11th, 2006. In addition to sponsorships by local businesses, the plantings will receive significant funding from Portland Parks and Recreation's Urban Forestry Division. Upcoming plantings are January 14th, Creston, Kenilworth, Laurelhurst, and Sunnyside, January 21st, East Moreland and Selwood Moreland, February 11th, Brentwood Darling and Foster Powell, March 11th, Montevilla, Mount Tabor, and Center. Friends of Trees inspires community stewardship of our urban forests by bringing people in the Portland-Vancouver area together to plant, care for, and learn about city trees. For more information about upcoming tree planting projects or about Friends of Trees, call 503-284-TREE. Or 503-284-8733 or visit www.friendsoftrees.org on the information superhighway. Portland Food Not Bombs invites you to participate in Feeding Portland's Hungry and Homeless at 5:30 p.m. at the North Park Blocks just north of Burnside by the elephant statue. You can also help your community in need by contacting the Oregon Community Warehouse. The Oregon Community Warehouse is in need of blankets, towels, and pots and pans. The Oregon Community Warehouse is located at 2267 North Interstate in Portland and accepts donations weekdays 9 to 5 p.m. They can also be reached on their website, www.oregoncommunitywarehouse.org, or by phone at 503-235-8786. And it's time to put on your thinking caps. City Repair invites you to propose a project for the 2006 Village Building Convergence. Projects can be place space, ecological, artistic, structural, social, even alive. The main goal is to promote cooperative community-based efforts to reconnect with each other and enhance the places we live. Details on previous projects, the proposal process, and requests for proposals are online at www.cityrepair.org or at City Repair Headquarters, 2122 Southeast Division, or call 503-235-8946 for more information. Proposals will be accepted through 5 p.m. on January 30th, 2006. You have been listening to the KBOO Community Calendar for Thursday, December 29th, 2005.